Welcome back. Here's our next story from today's Des Moines Register. Merrick wins tight race. Ankeny's Ethan Zuber left and Cedar Falls' Jaden Merrick run at the front of the pack during the 3,200-meter race Thursday at the Drake Relays. Merrick won in 8 minutes 55 seconds, .14, and Zuber was second at 8 minutes and 56 seconds, .68. And pictured above is Ethan Zuber and Jaden Merrick running on the Drake Relays track with their uniforms on. In another story, Javi Hurst overcomes ACL tear to win 100-meter hurdles. A little rainstorm wasn't going to hold back West Des Moines Valley's Emma Having. It wasn't a big deal to me, Javi Hurst said while cracking a smile. I'd rather be wet than cold. That's been the mentality for Javi Hurst throughout her junior season. After taking third in the 100-meter hurdles at last year's state track meet, behind a crop of talented seniors, she was laser-focused this year, no matter the obstacle. At the best returning runner at the state for the event, it was quite apparent to the naked eye that she would be the favorite. That was the case until she tore her ACL in June and had major reconstruction surgery on it in July. As she sat through the summer and fall with a full brace on her leg, going through the motions of rehab on her knee, she stewed on how she would find her way back into the track in time to finally break through. Missing out on all that off-season training that I knew can help me in the end, I knew I had to work hard during the season to get where I knew I could be, having her said. She wasted little time with her first day back training, coming on February 19th, the first day of the track and field season. Within a month, she was winning an indoor track and field title in the 60-meter hurdles with a time of 8.93 seconds. She has nearly surpassed her own school record time already this season, despite the recent surgery, with the Iowa leading time in 2024 of 14.52 seconds, which she posted at the Johnson Quad Meet. Her personal best comes from last season's Class 4A track state track meet, the 18th best time in Iowa history at 14.47, which earned her third place that day. After the season best time at Johnston, she set her sights on the Blue Oval, never having a honor of hoisting a white flag of the Drake Relays title either. In the preliminaries, she ran an event-leading 14.67. In the finals, she got off to a blistering start and glided her way to a victory over the Des Moines heavy field. Her time, 14.67. Despite the major knee surgery, despite the downpour of rain that delayed the Drake Relays just minutes after the conclusion of her race, Javier's found a way to be the state's most consistent force in the 100 hurdles. Through it all, she's proud of her toughness and perseverance through adversity as she gears up to attempt with her first state championship next month. It's something that I work on internally, having her said. It's just something that I'm really proud of myself, that I can show to everyone in the stadium and get to share that with other people.
Jones hopes to qualify for Olympic trials. This is written by Alyssa Hertel. Lolo Jones hopes that there is a bit of a home track advantage at play on Saturday. The Des Moines native is slated to compete in the Drake Relays 100-meter hurdles at 3 p.m. The event will be televised nationally on CBS Sports Network. Jones, who has competed at several Drake Relays going back to elementary school, brings plenty of experience on the Blue Oval this weekend. That could prove helpful for the 41-year-old hurdler attempting to hit the 12.95 second mark, the qualifying time for the Olympic trials. I'm definitely training to qualify for Olympic trials, Jones said during a press conference on Thursday. I've run 13.11 this year, so we're right there. Jones competed in the 2008 and 2012 Summer Olympics as a hurdler. She competed in the 2014 Winter Olympics as a bobsledder. Jones debated entering the Masters division at the Drake Relays. There, she would have a chance to break the world record, but Jones made it clear she is here to compete. If she wants to make the Olympics, she understands that competing in an older age category just to win won't help her. The odds to be an Olympic athlete, even when you're healthy, peak, and it's a 1% chance, Jones said. If you don't know how to overcome odds, you are not destined to be an Olympian. She wants to represent for Iowa track and field athletes, and she got a head start prior to the press conference. Jones, who became the first four-time winner in the women's 100-meter hurdles at Drake Relays, was inducted into the Relays Hall of Fame on Thursday afternoon. She will look to carry that momentum into Saturday's competition, and let it be known that Jones plans to compete, rain or shine. I've thought about this, Jones says. For selfish reasons, I want good weather because I would love to run 12.95 and get my Olympic trials qualifying standard here. That would be amazing, but the weather might take some people out. Your local bobsled athlete will check in. A little rain? I've competed in snow and blizzards, so that's going to give you the competitive edge to get a win. I'll roll with whatever. And then our final article for the Drake Relays in today's paper, also written by Alyssa Hertel, is Norwalk's Anania sets new PR in debut. Tony Anania didn't start his athletic career on the track, but it is where the former basketball player found his rhythm, and it has paid off this season. The Norwalk junior ran a 4 minute 14.1 second in the 1600 meter run and a 9 minute 9.62 in the 3200, both the best times in the state entering Drake Relays. He competed in the 1300 on Thursday, but even his best time wasn't enough on the blue oval against two athletes, Jaden Merrick from Cedar Falls and Ethan Zuber from Ankeny, who broke the 9 minute mark. Anania finished fifth. And he did set a personal best time of 9 minutes, 7.79 seconds. It was super surreal to be part of that race, Anania said while attempting to catch his breath. We got two of the best guys duking it out, and then to come away with a personal record, it's a blessing. He was swallowed by the pack early, but recovered well and worked his way into the fifth spot for the first lap. Anania moved up to fourth after the second, but slipped back a bit in the middle legs of the race. With a couple laps remaining, he moved back into fifth and remained in that spot through the end of the race. Anania admits that he felt some pressure coming into Drake Stadium as the statewide leader, but his coaches reminded him that this was just another race, something the Warriors athlete could use to prepare for district meets and eventually the state track meet. Besides, a fifth-place finish in his Drake Relays debut is no small feat. In Anania's third-ever season of track, he walked away with a top-five finish against some of the toughest competition in the state. Before track, it was all about basketball for the Norwalk runner. I played basketball until my freshman year, Anania said, and I just realized after my freshman track season that I could be really good at track. So I decided to quit basketball and focus on track and see what I can do. And now we're here. Anania isn't finished with the Drake Relays just yet. He will compete in the 800-meter run, the 4x800 relay, and the 1600 medley relay. Then he will set his sights on the state track meet next month. I tried to focus on having fun, not really worry about time or place, Anania said. It's like a preview for state, so I just want to focus on having fun rather than my time. And he did have fun, that's certain. Oh, yeah, my legs probably didn't, but I had a lot of fun.
NFL will allow players to wear guardian caps in games. The NFL is taking another huge step in its bid to improve player safety while specifically attempting to reduce head injuries in an inherently violent sport. The league revealed Thursday that guardian caps, which have steadily become a fixture in practices, will be authorized for use in games during the 2024 season. So we have expanded the practice mandate to all players with still the option for quarterbacks, kickers, and punters. But then also there is an option for the player to wear it in the game if he so chooses. Don Aponte, the NFL's chief administrator of football operations, said during a health and safety webinar. There were a number of clubs that had already required all of their players to wear those in helmeted practices. It's something of a seismic shift as it pertains to game day, but players have generally embraced the padded covers attached to the outside of the helmet per league and analytics collected over the past decade. If one player is wearing the guardian cap all at the time of a helmet hit, the cap will absorb at least 10% of the force. If both players are wearing the cap and have a helmet-to-helmet hit, the force of the impact is reduced by at least 20%. Given that level of injury prevention, it appears players are okay with form over fashion, at a time when the league is also encouraging players to strongly consider position-specific helmets designed to minimize their exposure to head injuries based on even more specific risk factors. "It's really becoming norm here," said Los Angeles Rams equipment director Brendan Berger. "The players know the caps. They've seen the data. It works. The guardian caps have become another piece of equipment that they take to practice. You think about all the head impacts that we're reducing from players wearing them, and it's a second nature now." Berger also shared that the Rams opted for additional use of the caps in practice back in 2021 after quarterback Matthew Stafford injured his throwing hand in training camp. Upon hitting it on an uncapped helmet while following through on a pass. Winners, losers from round one. Drafts showcase night spotlights signal callers and those who make plays for them. Round one of the 2024 NFL Draft may go down as a watershed moment for what has already been long described as a quarterback league. That was certainly the case Thursday night in downtown Detroit, when the passers and players who directly support them flew off the board at an unprecedented rate. The aftermath leaves plenty of intrigue and controversy ahead of the draft's next 2 days, along with runaway optimism and perhaps relief in the other quarterbacks. The event is only 12% complete, but it feels like 88% of its major lead-in questions were answered. Though others have certainly surfaced as we break down the winners and losers of the first round. For the winners, Chicago Bears. To the surprise of absolutely no one, former USC officially arrived with the number one overall pick, but the acquisition of wide receiver Rome Odunze at number 9 arguably topped Chicago's rebuild with the two best players in the entire draft. But there's almost no argument that this team should be ready to win and contend this season. Williams, with a chance to quickly emerge as this franchise's best passer of the Super Bowl era since 1966. Pac-12. The once vaunted conference is effectively dead, cannibalized by the expansion of other FBS football leagues, but it went out with a nice bang. 8 players with Williams at the top, tabbed Thursday. It didn't beat out the SEC, but a nice homage to the once great West Football Football Forum. Wesley Adolfo Mensah. The Minnesota Vikings third-year general manager, who acquired a second-round for one spot last month, also executed Thursday night's first two trades, but didn't, as was widely expected, have to surrender one of his first-round slots to select a quarterback, Adolfo Mensah. played it relatively safe, moving up one rung in a flip with the New York Jets to get Michigan quarterback J.J. McCarthy at number 10. He was a bit more aggressive later, advancing six spots in a deal with the Jacksonville Jaguars to acquire Alabama pass rusher Dallas Turner. Regarded by some as the best defender in the field, the Vikes may well be at last place outfit in what's shaping up to be a rugged NFC North in 2024, but their on-the-fly rebuild appears to be smoothly rolling down the tracks, especially as it pertains to the support system of McCarthy. Offense. The first 14 players selected were on the sexy side of the ball, double the previous record to kick off the first round in the history of the draft, 23 offensive players overall, including 6 quarterbacks, 7 wideouts, and 9 linemen, heard their names called. Another new round, one benchmark after eclipsing the previous one by 4. Maybe this draft will ultimately prove an outlier, or maybe it's indicative that a league that continues to skew its rules to emphasize scoring while protecting the players who create the most highlights will literally invest more of its resources, draft, salary cap, or otherwise, into offense. Leitu Latu, the Indianapolis Colts made the former UCLA pass rusher the first defender chosen, taking him 15th overall. And Latu, with his array of pass rush moves, high motor, and ability to drop into coverage, has more than a legit case as the best defensive player coming out this year. But the fact that he seems so universally beloved by his peers and teammates while overcoming a neck injury that led to his temporary medical retirement 3 years ago, and nearly led him into a career in firefighting, makes his story that much more endearing. Patrick Mahomes, the best player in the league, will now have the fastest player in the history of the scouting combine, wide receiver Xavier Worthy, and his 4.21 second 40 time, and his disposal at the third or fourth option in HC Andy Reid's offense. How those odds looking on that unprecedented Kansas City Chiefs three-peat bid. And the losers, quarterbacks, Thursday very much illustrated teams are investing and or reinvesting at the position at an intense rate. But these young slingers need look no further than 3 years to get a sense of how expendable they're becoming. First round pedigree or not, 4 of the 5 quarterbacks taken in round 1 in 2021 are already on different teams, none assured of starting again. Kenny Pickett, the lone quarterback taken on day 1 in 2022, is already an ex-Steeler himself. This isn't to suggest this year's crop will fail, though history tells us 3 of the 6 probably will. But there's no doubt the runaway for and patience afforded these young arms isn't near what it used to be. Kirk Cousins, a month after signing a 4-year, $180 million contract to join the Atlanta Falcons, KFC has already been blindsided, and not by a pass rusher. After his new team made Thursday's most stunning move by selecting Washington quarterback Michael Penix Jr., 8th overall, feels like Cousins is already on a hot seat before even taking a home snap in ATL. And then Michael Penix Jr., a sublimely talented passer who turns 24 next month. No telling now when Penix, a starter the past 6 seasons at the FBS level, will be back in the lineup now that he's stuck behind Cousins for the foreseeable future. A guy who finally shook the injury bug. His 4 seasons at Indiana were curtailed by knee and shoulder woes. Might have to cope with being a healthy scratch for at least the next 2 years.
Spring shopping, the best college football players still available in this portal cycle. This is written by Eric Smith for the USA Today. The end of spring practices across the country signals the reopening of the college football transfer portal. Many players who have gone through off-season workouts are looking for new homes after finding their current roster situation isn't to their liking. Others may have been told their opportunities to see the field aren't promising or that their playing time this fall will be diminished. Some of those looking for some new opportunities will be familiar names or heralded recruits who can step into their programs and provide immediate impact. Who are the best ones available in the cycle? Here's the best of the best that will be in demand from schools looking to improve their rosters. Keandre Lambert-Smith, a wide receiver from Penn State. Lambert Smith considered entering the NFL draft after leading the Nittany Lions with 673 receiving yards. His return was seen as a major coup with Penn State in need of a receiving options to help make its offense more explosive against top defenses. But Lambert Smith won't be part of that group this fall and will look to make an impact elsewhere. Damian Martinez, a running back from Oregon State, a running back who totaled more than 1,000 yards rushing in a Power 5 league last season, is going to draw interest from major programs. Martinez put up big numbers for the Beavers last year and stayed this spring despite the loss of coach Jonathan Smith to Michigan State and the school in a transition phase from the Pac-12 down to two teams. Now he is available on the market and should be in demand. Caden Proctor, an offensive lineman from Iowa. It's already been an eventful career for Proctor. After just one season in college football, he committed to staying home at Iowa as one of the top high school recruits in the 2023 class before signing with Alabama. As a freshman, he was an immediate starter for the Crimson Tide, but decided to transfer to the Hawkeyes after the retirement of Nick Saban. A few months later, Proctor is back in the portal and looks to be returning to Tuscaloosa. Damionic Williams, a defensive lineman from TCU, a two-year starter for the Horned Frogs. Williams helped the team in the college football playoff title game as a freshman and followed that up with 33 tackles and 3 sacks in 2023. He is expected to draw attention from any number of teams looking to fortify their defensive line. Cormani McLean, a defensive back from Colorado, one of the prized high school recruits from the first recruiting class of Deion Sanders. McLean struggled to make his mark in his one season with the Buffaloes. He played in 9 games and registered 13 tackles. Previously committed to Miami, McLean could potentially return to his home state of Florida or be wooed elsewhere. Takario Davis, a defensive back from Arizona. Davis is one of the many significant losses for the Wildcats after the departure of coach Jed Fish for Washington. He led the Pac-12 with 15 pass breakups and will be a valuable addition to a team seeking an immediate starter in the secondary. Elijah Herring, a linebacker from Tennessee. It's rare to see a leading tackler from an SEC school available in the portal. Herring's decision to leave Knoxville after starting 11 games and posting 80 tackles comes with his playing time uncertain due to the return of Keenan Pille. Still, his production makes him an attractive option for programs with a need in the middle of their defense. Jason Zandamella, an offensive lineman from Southern Cal, one of the top signings for the Trojans last December. Zandamella leaves after going through his first spring practice. He may not be ready to be an instant starter this fall, but this is a potential project in the interior of the offensive line that could pay big dividends in the future. Penny Boone, a running back from Louisville. Boone ran for 1,400 yards and 15 touchdowns for Toledo last season before making the move to Louisville this winter. But after spring practice with the Cardinals, he is on the move again and should have plenty of options. His size at 6'1", 242 pounds is unique to this position. Jaden Rashada, a quarterback from Arizona State. It's already been quite a college journey for Rashada. He signed with Florida in 2023 and left before the season after a fallout with his NIL deal that now has the Gators under NCAA investigation. He started the first two games for the Sun Devils before an injury sidelined him until the team's final game against Arizona, and now he'll try to find his footing at another program. Sam Brown, a wide receiver from Houston, the leading receiver for the Cougars, is headed out to catch passes for another school. Brown totaled 815 yards on 62 catches in a breakout season. His skills should be valued by any team looking for a wide receiver who can play right away. And finally, Jacob E. Matthews, a defensive back from Texas A&M. It's been an off-season of transition for the Aggies, with Mike Elko taking over from Jimbo Fisher. Matthews is the latest starter from last year's defense who is departing for a portal. He registered 42 tackles in his first season of major contribution. And our last article for the Register's sports section is written by Ihsan Kassim for the USA Today Network. Mr. Irrelevant, an NFL history lesson. Perhaps no player other than San Francisco quarterback Brock Purdy has brought more attention to the nickname Mr. Irrelevant. It was first coined in 1976 by former USC receiver and NFL draftee Paul Salatan, who founded the annual celebration and charity event to honor the final pick of the NFL draft. Dayton's Kelvin Kirk became the first official Mr. Irrelevant that same year. Though Purdy is among the most memorable players to don the nickname, he's certainly not the only one, nor is he the only notable selection. Here's a look at Mr. Irrelevant's tradition, what it means, and a couple of standouts who have emerged from the final pick. What is Mr. Irrelevant in the NFL draft? The term Mr. Irrelevant is the name of the last player taken in the NFL draft in a given year. Despite the name, which could come off as a term of derision, it is described by Salata in positive terms. We established Irrelevant Week to drive home an important message that it's not a negative to be picked last in the NFL draft. Rather, it's an honor to be drafted at all, Salata said on the organization's website. The last draft pick's demonstration of perseverance is a lesson that resonates not only with NFL players and fans, but also with people everywhere. Salata played for USC before playing for the FC NFL's San Francisco 49ers in 1949 to 1950, and then in 1950 for the Baltimore Colts. After the Colts franchise folded, he was declared eligible for the draft and selected as the 118th overall, 10th round, in the 1951 NFL draft by the Steelers. In 1976, Kirk was the first player honored as Mr. Irrelevant and joined Irrelevant Week, the annual celebration that the NFL recognizes honoring the draft's final pick. What number is Mr. Irrelevant? Mr. Irrelevant refers only to the last selection of the NFL draft in a given year, not any specific number. That's because the number of picks in a given draft vary by year to year based on compensatory picks awarded to teams. For example, the Mr. Irrelevant of the 2023 NFL draft, Rams defensive end Deshaun Johnson, was pick number 259. Brock Purdy, who went with the last pick in 2022, was pick number 262. Tampa Bay Buccaneers lineman Grant Stewart went with pick number 259 in 2021, whereas the New York Giants linebacker Tay Crowder went number 255 in 2020. Mr. Irrelevant will go with pick number 257 this year. The history of Mr. Irrelevant and Irrelevant Week. Irrelevant Week has become a staple and an important charitable event. According to the organization's website, it has raised more than $1 million to donate to charities over the last four decades. The American Cancer Society, Big Brothers Big Sisters, Goodwill Industries, YMCA, Special Olympics, Habitat for Humanity, NFL alumni, and the American Red Cross are among the organizations that have benefited. Salata announced the draft's final pick in 2013 when his daughter Melanie Salata Fitch took over the organization. Salata died in 2021 at the age of 94. In early summer following the draft, Mr. Irrelevant makes a trip to Newport Beach, California for a week's worth of events, including a tour of Disneyland, media opportunities, participating in a sailing regatta in the world-famous Newport Harbor, and attending a Major League ball game. The week rounds out with Mr. Irrelevant as the guest of honor at the annual Lozman Banquet, which features past and present sports stars and celebrates a chance to roast the guest of honor. The event includes a silent auction followed by Mr. Irrelevant being awarded the Lozman Trophy, which mimics the Heisman but depicts a football player fumbling a football. Dijon Johnson was Mr. Irrelevant in 2023. Johnson is the most recent Mr. Irrelevant selection heading into the 2024 NFL Draft, and the defensive end from Toledo, the Rams, with the final pick of the 2023 draft, appearing in 11 games in 2023 NFL season for Los Angeles. He notched 9 total tackles, 5 solo. He also had 2 sacks and a forced fumble. Mr. Irrelevant, Brock Purdy. Purdy was the final pick of the 2023 NFL draft on a San Francisco 49ers team that included former first-round pick Trey Lance and incumbent Jimmy Garoppolo. Lance went down with a season-ending injury in Week 2, and Garoppolo saw his season end in Week 13, paving the way for Purdy. He led the 49ers to 5 straight regular season wins, throwing for 13 touchdowns and just 4 interceptions. The rookie quarterback defeated the Seattle Seahawks and Dallas Cowboys in the first 2 rounds of the NFC playoffs. Purdy tore his UCL during the NFC Championship game but re-entered when backup Josh Johnson suffered an injury of his own. Purdy led San Francisco back to the Super Bowl during the 2023 season, posting a 17-4 record over his first 2 seasons with 5,654 yards, 44 touchdowns, and 15 interceptions. Among the most notable Mr. Irrelevant picks are Ryan Sukup from 2009 and Marty Moore in 1994. The Kansas City Chiefs selected Sukup as pick number 256 in the 2009 draft out of South Carolina, playing 14 seasons in the NFL for the Chiefs, Titans, and Buccaneers. He connected on 320 of his 386, that's 83% of his kicks, and 96% of his extra point attempts. He became the first Mr. Irrelevant to start in the Super Bowl, where he hit 4 extra points and connected on a field goal to help Tom Brady and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers defeat Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs 31-9 in Super Bowl number 55. The New England Patriots selected Moore as the number 222 pick in 1994 draft out of Kentucky. He played 8 seasons in the NFL, all but 2 with the Patriots. In 1997, he became the first Mr. Irrelevant to play in the Super Bowl when New England lost 35-21 to Green Bay in Super Bowl 31. Following a stint with Cleveland, Moore ended his career with the Patriots, which won Super Bowl 36 and Tom Brady's first championship. Moore became the first Mr. Irrelevant to win a Super Bowl as well.
Halliburton lifts Pacers to 2-1 series edge. Tyrese Halliburton converted a 3-point play with 1.6 seconds left in overtime, lifting the Indiana Pacers to a 121-118 win over the Milwaukee Bucks on Friday in Game 3 of their Eastern Conference first-round series in Indianapolis. Halliburton gained separation after using a nifty crossover on Patrick Beverley before sinking a shot from the foul line. He added a free throw to complete his 18-point, 16-assist, 10-rebounds performance and overcome a scintillating 42-point effort by Milwaukee's Chris Middleton. "I just knew I was shooting it," Halliburton said. "No matter what, I didn't know what I was going to get to. It was just based off of a feel out there. As soon as I saw Patrick kind of turn his head, I just rejected and That opened everything up across the middle, and I finally made a shot. I couldn't buy a ticket today, and I'm glad that one went in. Miles Turner collected 29 points and 9 rebounds, and Pascal Siakam added 17 points and 9 rebounds to help the 6-seeded Pacers seize a 2-1 lead in their best-of-7 series. Game 4 is Sunday in Indianapolis. Middleton drained a 3-pointer to tie the score at 111-111 with 2.3 seconds remaining in the fourth quarter. Middleton was not alone. However, as he answered Aaron Nesmith's corner 3 by banking home his shot from beyond the arc, with 8 seconds left in overtime before Halliburton's heroics. He said he felt better as the game went on. "Now we have to make sure Damian Lillard is okay," Bucks coach Doc Rivers said of Middleton, who was questionable to play in Game 3 because of an ankle injury he suffered in Game 2. Lillard overcame an apparent left leg injury late in the first quarter to finish with 28 points, 8 assists, and 3 steals. "I think it's his Achilles again. We'll see," Rivers said when he asked about Lillard's injury. Bobby Portis collected 17 points and 18 rebounds for the third-seeded Bucks, who played their 6th straight game without 2-time NBA MVP Giannis Antetokounmpo left calf strain. Rivers was asked about the possibility of Antetokounmpo playing in Game 4. "Only if he's healthy," Rivers said. "We're not going to rush anyone back. It's too dangerous." Milwaukee erased a 19-point deficit and secured a 93-92 lead after Lillard sank consecutive 3-pointers early in the fourth quarter. Lillard added 4 more 3 throws, and Portis sank a 3-pointer before Turner responded to tie the score at 104-104 with 4 minutes and 10 seconds remaining. Lillard made a driving layup to trim Indiana's lead to 16-12 before the Pacers ignited a 23-10 run to finish the first quarter. Obi Toppin drained a mid-range jumper as part of his 11-point contribution during that sequence.
And in NASCAR news, the Cup Series, 4 drivers vie for win at Dover. Ford Motorsports came tantalizingly close to winning its first NASCAR Cup Series race in the season last weekend at Talladega, but neither Michael McDowell nor Brad Keselowski could make it happen at the end. The 2 Blue Oval drivers will look to break the drought Sunday afternoon when they compete in the Worth 400 at Dover Motor Speedway in Dover, Delaware, the 11th race on the 2024 schedule. And what a 2024 it's been so far for Ford Motorsports. While the most casual glance at the win column reveals a bad start for the teams, 0-10, taking the whole season into consideration is even worse. Ford failed to win in the season-opening exhibition race in California, the Busch Light Clash at the Coliseum. At the legendary Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum, as Denny Hamlin walked away with a win. At Daytona during Speed Weeks, the blue-clad teams fared no better. Toyota's Tyler Reddick and Christopher Bell won the duels and Daytona's 500 qualifying races, so really 0-13. As for the point standings, only one Ford, the number 12, driven by reigning series champion Ryan Blaney at number 7, graces the top 11, and 4 of its drivers have combined to record just 5 stage wins thus far. That's a whole lot of time being any place other than at the front of the field. When they were running 1-2 Saturday in the 188th lap at Talladega, one had to figure McDowell, a Daytona 500 winner, or Keselowski, a 6-time Talladega winner, would manage to make it to victory lane with his dark horse Mustang in good shape. However, neither could be blamed for what issued. A chaotic melee that ended with Reddick roaring through the mess, stealing the checkers for his first victory at Talladega and crowding the trophy case for 23-9 team owner, NBA icon Michael Jordan, even more. But neither Ford driver was finger-pointing afterwards, even though a win would likely have put the winner into the playoffs and given either McDowell or his third career cup win or snapped Keselowski's 107-race winless streak. Nobody did anything wrong there, not Michael, not Brad, not anyone, said Fox analyst Larry McReynolds. What Ford has to hang their hat on is they had a fast Ford Mustang, the super speedways, the road courses, and we've got a lot more of those coming up. That's obviously their best opportunities to go to victory lane and maybe punch their ticket to the playoffs. On the high banks of the 1 mile Dover Speed Motor Speedway, the last two victories for Ford were in cars driven by current Booth analyst Kevin Harvick. That would be in 2018 and 2020. Since the 2009 season, the manufacturer has won just 3 times in 27 races. Keselowski does have a win there, a 2012 Triumph, but it was while he was driving for Dodge Motorsports during his title-winning season. The nicknamed the Monster Mile, DMS, might be too monstrous of a chunk of concrete for Ford to bust through. And in tennis for the Madrid Open, Alcaraz returns from injury and wins in Madrid. Number 2 seed Carlos Alcaraz began his quest for a three-peat at the Matua Madrid Open by beating Alexander Shevchenko 6-2, 6-1 in just 68 minutes Friday in his native Spain. Alcaraz had to withdraw from the tournaments in Monte Carlo and Barcelona with a right arm injury, and on Friday he wore a compression sleeve on the arm but did not appear limited. He hit 19 winners to Shevchenko's 2 and broke the Kasna's serve 7 times in 11 opportunities. I think I did pretty well, honestly, Alvarez said post-match. The last month I just practiced slices, volleys, and backhands, so I think it worked pretty well today. That was something I was thinking about approaching this match, trying to hit the forehand softer, let's say, and trying to be aggressive with the backhand, trying to crash the net as soon as possible. I think I did a really good match in that part. Alcaraz advanced to round 32 to face Brazil's Tiago Seibuth Wild, who upset number 28 seed Lorenzo Musetti of Italy 6-4, 6-4. Number 7 seed Andrei Rublev of Russia ended his recent struggles, at least for now, by sweeping past Argentine qualifier Facundo Bagnas 6-1, 6-4. Rublev had lost 4 straight matches entering Friday. Number 4, Alexander Zverev of Germany, beat Croatia's Borna Koric 6-3, 6-2, while number 8, Hubert Hurkacz of Poland, took down Great Britain's Jack Draper 6-1, 7-5. Number 11, Holger Rune of Denmark, needed 3 sets to overcome Argentine foe Mariana Navoni 5-7, 6-7, 6, and then 6-4. Rune stood 2 points from defeat when he was down 5-7, 5-6, 15-30 before capitalizing on his opponent's consecutive double faults. Also advancing in straight sets were number 12, Taylor Ritz, number 13, Hugo Humbert of France, number 21, Francisco Corandola of Argentina, and number 23, Jan Leonard Struff of Germany. Number 15 seed Tommy Paul survived a scare from Slovak qualifier Lucas Klein and won 6-7, 6-1, 6-4, while number 18 Sebastian Baez of Argentina outlasted Frenchman Luca Van Asch 6-4, 6-7, and 6-3. We're going to go ahead and take a look at the Iowa Lifestyle section of the Des Moines Register. First article is written by Susan Stapleton. It's titled Prime and Providence Installs a Hearth and Grill with Celebrity Chef Ties. Construction workers at Prime and Providence, the new steakhouse from chef and co-owner Dominic Annarelli opening in West Des Moines, already installed the buttery leather booths, the modern light fixtures overhead, and the rentable lockers that will store bottles of whiskey and wine out at the front. But perhaps most exciting for Annarelli, The Hearth from Grills by DeMont. Owner Chris DeMont came from Atlanta to personally oversee the installation of the equipment in the kitchen at the restaurant opening in May. Everything's custom, DeMont said, but at the same time, my grills are modular. They're so scalable, so you can get them small or you can get them 20 feet long. Chefs and restaurateurs can request the grill to reach the hood, put the grill on rollers to move them around, and determine what plug-and-play components to include, like a rotisserie, an elevator tower to rotate food over the heat, or more grill gates. Inarelli's hearth includes a 12-foot grill with skewers, smoke boxes, and a speed rack system for different grates. I've been a huge fan of his work, said Inarelli, who saw DeMont's grills in person at chef and restaurateur Sean Brock's South Restaurant June in Nashville. You may have seen these grills by DeMont at these restaurants. Readers may have been seeing DeMont's work on The Menu, the 2022 thriller from Succession director Mark Mylod and starring Anya Taylor-Joy and Ralph Fiennes. Production designer Ethan Taubman told Architectural Digest that he worked with Dominic Crenn, the chef behind San Francisco's 3 Michelin-starred Altair Crenn, who created the kitchen for the fictional restaurant Hawthorne on a soundstage in Hampton Island, Georgia. A grill by DeMont was part of the set in the working kitchen. DeMont also installed his grill at Islas in a Brooklyn restaurant, from Mads Resflund, formerly of Noma, as well as Frank Fink's Hestia of Austin, Texas, and South Hall Farm and Inn in Franklin, Tennessee. Inarelli said he talked to DeMont about what he wanted on the grill for about 30 minutes. He knew exactly what we were doing, he said. The grill includes 2 big charcoal ovens as well. Prime in Providence also marks the first time DeMont built an oyster case, which will sit to the right of the grill and have its own bar seating. DeMont, who is originally from Denmark, started building grills 6 or 7 years ago. It's so cool that you get to do something artistic with the metal that is highly functional, he said. It's a functional piece that we can make beautiful. You see the fire and the smoke and all the meats hanging and everything's dribbling, and it's just like a big spectacle to look at. Now, Inarelli needs to pass a fire inspection before he can fire up the hearth and start working on dishes. Chef Dominic Inarelli, who most recently served as executive chef and director of restaurants for Splash Seafood and Jethro's Barbecue and worked with the company for 23 years, left to open his own restaurant this spring. Prime in Providence promises to bring a modern twist to the steak and seafood genre when it opens at 595 South 60th Street in West Des Moines. The restaurant, built from scratch from the ground up, is part of the 595 Tower, a new 5-story building whose master developer is DRA Properties. Retail and restaurant take up the lower level, with commercial real estate broker CBRE moving into the second floor and 10 owner-occupied condos filling floors 3 through 5. So again, the location is at 595 South 60th Street in West Des Moines, and you can contact them on Instagram at instagram.com/primeandprovidence or on Facebook at facebook.com/primeandprovidence.
Trained professional can help you quit drinking. Many patients within my practice encounter the significant challenge of excessive alcohol consumption. Concurrently, they often divulge additional stressors in their lives, such as marital discord, familial life, occupational pressures, or unresolved traumas. Despite repeated attempts to curtail or cease alcohol intake, many find themselves unsuccessful in their endeavors. These patients are cognizant of the negative effects of alcohol on their ability to manage many aspects of their lives. However, a common misstep lies in attempting to stop drinking without first comprehending the underlying factors contributing to their reliance on alcohol. Consequently, they lack attentive coping mechanisms to replace alcohol consumption. Alcohol abuse and addiction often stem from a tendency to evade distressing emotions. Individuals may have learned at some juncture in their lives that alcohol temporarily alleviates uncomfortable feelings, thereby fostering a risky inclination towards repetitive, unhealthy coping behaviors. Over time, escalating consumption becomes necessary to achieve the same degree of emotional numbing. leading to a heightened level of depression and anxiety upon the return to sobriety, thus continuing a vicious cycle. Abrupt cessation of alcohol consumption can feel as though the rug has been pulled from beneath one's feet. While discomfort is an inevitable aspect of this process, it serves as a catalyst for addressing the underlying issues that precipitated alcohol misuse. Essential to this endeavor is the establishment of a strong support system and the gain of healthy coping strategies to replace alcohol reliance. Developing the insight to recognize cravings as manifestations of an attempt to evade uncomfortable situations facilitates a deeper understanding of one's behavioral patterns, thereby enabling the pursuit of appropriate support and solutions. Beneath the surface of alcohol abuse often lies unresolved trauma, untreated anxiety and depression, each exacerbating the other in a complex interplay. Recognizing this interconnectedness underscores the necessity of addressing both substance abuse and underlying mental health concerns concurrently. Seeking professional assistance is strongly advised for individuals grappling with problematic alcohol use. There are a lot of factors that make managing alcohol complicated, including genetics, media, social situations, occupational environment, and family patterns. The manifested nature of the challenges associated with reducing or abstaining from alcohol warrants the guidance of a trained professional who can often educate, insight, support, and accountability. Addiction thrives in secrecy, and the act of reaching out for help constitutes a powerful stride toward cultivating a healthier self.
And tips for your garden, your flower garden, from a star horticulturalist. This is written by Jackie Runes for the USA Today. Walking into a plant nursery can be overwhelming, especially when you want a stunning flower garden at home. Before the planting season begins, look for guidance from experts. We tap Steve Foltz, Director of Horticulture at the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden, for help with flower garden ideas and tips. He's been with the Horticulture Department since 1988, taught university-level courses in horticulture for 3 decades, and is a member of the Kentucky Nursery and Landscape Hall of Fame. He knows his stuff. We ask the important questions and Foltz answers. Want your flower garden to resemble those at Zoo Blooms, an annual event at the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden, also voted the best flower festival in the USA Today's 10 Best Reader's Choice Awards? You're in the right place. How do you arrange a flower garden? Like all things, your best bet is to keep it simple. Foltz says to use drifts of color in your home flower garden and to use the most color in high traffic areas like walkways, patios, and decks. Keep in mind that annuals require care and even the hardiest need to be watered and fertilized, so your flower bed should be near water outlets. What flowers are best for a flower garden? For a colorful flower garden with mad curb appeal, Foltz suggests the following easy-to-grow blooms, whether you plant them directly in the ground or in container gardens. So best for sunny areas in your flower garden, petunias. Choose bright colors like Vista Bubblegum Pink or Supertunia Vista Jazzberry. Lantana. Good choices include Citrus Blend and Lucky Pot of Gold. Or Sweet Potato Vine. Marguerite is a great ground cover in sunny spots. It cascades over walls and is a vigorous grower. Zinnias. Zahara Fire is a low plant with bright orange flowers, or try any of the Profusion Zinnia series. Salvia, Mystic Spires Blue, is a terrific pollinator plant. or go for the big blue and blue suede shoes varieties. And grass, purple fountain grass, is super easy. The best areas for shade, or the best for shady areas in your flower garden, impatiens. Foltz especially likes the Sun Patience Compact Electric Orange. Begonias, Dragon Wing Series, Megawatt Series, and Surefire Cherry Cordial are Foltz's favorites. And Coleus, Foltz likes the vegetative varieties like the Color Blaze Series or the Main Street Series. Should you plant seeds or use potted plants for a flower garden? Foltz suggests visiting your local garden store that sells well-grown annuals that are in either flats or 4-inch pots. Most of the time, the vigorous plants that do well are in 4-inch pots, he added. Growing from seed can be fun in the back of the garden, but when you're really counting on color, buy plants. How do you prepare the soil for planting flowers? Prep soil for a garden flower garden starts with knowing the type of soil that's native to your area. You may have to apply some elbow grease to get the dirt in good enough shape to plant annuals. The most important tip is to dig up your soil with a shovel or a small rototiller to make sure it's loose and soft, Foltz explains. Try for 6 to 8 inches deep, and if you can't dig with your hands, the soil is not ready. If you have to chip away at the soil to plant your flowers, you are in for an uphill battle in which you will not win. Consider a soil test kit, ranges from $10 to $20, to determine your soil's composition, alkalinity, and acidity, Foltz says. If you're working your dirt and adding organic matter occasionally when preparing your beds, you should be in good shape. How often do you need to water and fertilize a flower garden? Assuming you adequately prepared your soil, water your flower garden immediately after planting and keep an eye on them for the next week or so. The first week, we fertilize with a liquid feed you can attach to your hose like Miracle-Gro or something similar, the horticulturalist advises, and you can use slow-release fertilizer as a top dress as well. Then it is a matter of making sure the color of your leaves stays good and dark green. Once the annuals are established, water 2 times a week. If it rains, you may need to water sometimes because sometimes it doesn't soak the ground. If you're unsure, stick your finger in the soil at the base of the plant and feel if it is wet or dry. How do you extend the blooming season of a flower garden? By using the recommended plants from our trials at the Botanical Garden, Foltz says. We expect our annuals to look good from May to the first frost. If they are short season color, they don't get the Zoo's Best Annuals moniker. For more flower garden ideas, check out the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden's guide to planning your garden.
Thank you. Here's a reminder that you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. You can listen to podcasts of this and many other IRIS programs at iowaradioreading.org. My name is Nicholas Herter, and my partner at the microphone has been Lisa Horsch. Earlier, you heard Ella Gibson and Justin Gibson. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.